Welcome to Between the Worlds. I'm your host, Amanda Yates Garcia. Stay tuned and learn how to re-enchant your world with tarot, magic, and more. Thanks for traveling with us. We're glad you're here. One especially delicious tool we can use to help deepen our knowledge of the tarot is literature. Today, we're discussing the meaning of the devil card with Milton scholar Michael Ursell. In this episode, you'll find out why the devil figure really is scary, but not for the reasons that you might think. So stay tuned. Listeners, we've got some exciting things coming up for you. Tonight, Thursday the 25th of February at 6 p.m., is Between the Worlds Tarot Studio. I'll be sharing a hot tip, which you'll have the opportunity to practice. Once you master this tip, it really gives you so much confidence in your readings. Your readings go through the roof. I know they did for me. I can't wait to share that with you. Then on Sunday, March 7th at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, we've got a sigil workshop coming up for you, and we cannot wait to share that. A recording will be available for people who can't attend IRL, but in case you don't know, sigils are simple magical tools that you create yourself, used for manifesting your desires and improving your powers of concentration, which is an important skill for any magical working. You don't need to be able to draw to create a sigil. You just need to have a desire to make magic. Both of these treats are included in the cost of membership for our Jupiter level subscribers. So I hope you can join us. Then outside of Between the Worlds in my own biz, Oracle of Los Angeles, I've got a full moon ceremony coming up this Friday, the 26th. So that's tomorrow at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, where we'll be doing dream work in honor of Pisces season and identifying our calling in honor of the Virgo moon. So this ceremony is by donation. 10% of the proceeds will go to folks affected by the storms in Texas. I hope you all can be there. Anyone's free to attend that one. Link for all of this stuff is in the show notes.
Hi, Carolyn here, producer of Between the Worlds. Whoa, the Devil of Paradise Lost gives me serious overachieving Capricorn energy. In this spirit, I wanted to let you all know about a new podcast I'm producing for creative folks called Mind Your Practice, hosted by the devilishly brilliant author of Make Your Art No Matter What, Beth Pickens, also a known Capricorn. Mind Your Practice is geared towards artists and writers looking for strategies and support to build their projects and practices, plus loving pep talks. There's even a club, Homework Club, which offers creative people a framework for keeping their practices and projects a priority with actual homework. You can visit mindyourpractice.com for more details or listen wherever you stream Between the Worlds.
Today, we're talking about the archetype of the devil, also known as the adversary. And the more you understand the archetypes of the tarot, especially the major arcana, the richer your readings are going to be. That's for real. And we thought that the challenge of the devil card would be the perfect thing for sword season. Whenever I get a client who's never had a tarot reading before, I always make sure to tell them not to take the tarot literally. You know, I say, just because you get the death card doesn't mean you're going to die. Just because you get the devil card doesn't mean you're going to be possessed by the devil or anything like that. But the devil card really can be scary. It can really mean scary things when it comes up, because the devil card usually is pointing out our fatal flaw. In other words, the wound that is standing in our way and preventing us from getting the thing that we really want. The devil is the shadow at the gate of our unconscious mind. And it's also the shadow at the gate of the truest, most magnificent version of ourself. So it is scary because it's really the thing that we are avoiding and have constructed our entire psyche around avoiding. And that might be, for instance, something like pushing people away when really we want intimacy. I'm familiar with that one. Or not following through on some great opportunity at the last minute, even though you really want it, because you're afraid of failure or you're afraid of success. And let's be real, most of the time, the reason that we do that kind of stuff is because of trauma. I mean, if you dig into the roots of trauma or any of our personal issues or the quote-unquote psychological issues, it's almost always got political roots, because usually the reasons that we're constructing these defense mechanisms have to do with systemic oppression and trauma of one form or another. Like, for instance, you know, if you are defensive in relationships, it's probably because you learned that in your early childhood from your parents, and they learned that the world wasn't safe, and they taught that to you, and they learned that for political reasons, right? If we look deep enough. But the devil is also known as Lucifer, who is the light bringer. And when he brings that light, he brings that awareness, he brings the capacity to overcome our inner tyrants, and hopefully inspires us to overcome our outer tyrants as well, because I know that we're all involved in that project. And the devil then is a signifier of liberation. So that's exciting. We're going to be talking through all of this through the lens of literary theory, one of my favorite things, with scholar Michael Ursell. So Michael's a friend of mine. I adore him. He's super funny and charming and just the kindest person. He's an artist advocate, and he has a PhD in Milton. That is a rare thing indeed. And a few months ago, he was telling me the story of Paradise Lost, which is an epic poem by John Milton. And I was riveted, and I knew I had to share this story with all of you because I thought you would all find it really relevant. So one of the most famous devils in history appears in this epic poem by John Milton, Paradise Lost, and Michael is going to break it down for us, because Milton is notoriously hard to read. I have to admit that, you know, I'm a pretty good reader, and that's not what I wanted to admit, but what I wanted to admit is even though I am a good reader, I once tried to read Paradise Lost, and I was like, I don't know if I have the time for this. The language is very circuitous, and you know, it's very beautiful and evocative, but one of my teachers in high school, who was a Shakespeare scholar and loved all of that, you know, this 17th century work, said that she, when she was studying Milton in grad school, had to sit in a really uncomfortable chair in the library so that she wouldn't fall asleep while she was reading. But that's not because it's not interesting. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. It's just that today, you know, we're used to tweets and, you know, things that can fit in an Instagram caption, and we're not so used to reading this laborious language of Milton. Anyway, if Christian iconography isn't your bag, I don't blame you, but we're going to be looking at this story as we would any other piece of literature. So you don't have to think of it as like God or Christianity. I mean, God is a character, but you can think of him as a character, not as like a demand from Christianity or Islam or Catholicism or Judaism. Anyway, I think you're going to find this episode really interesting. So first, what we're going to do is give you a little background on Milton, because as you know, in magic and in all the arts, really, it always reflects the time in which it's produced. All magic does that. Our magic today is truly a product of our time. Just like, you know, the magic of the Golden Dawn in the early part of the 20th century in England was a product of that time. And so even though Milton was writing in the 17th century in England, the social upheaval he was experiencing really has remarkable symmetry with our situation right now. You're going to find a lot of things very familiar about it. And truly, it had major reverberations in the political world at the time, and we're still feeling those. We're still feeling those reverberations now in our lives today. So that's another reason to tune in for this. But so after we talk about Milton, we're going to get into the story of Paradise Lost itself, which is a book that permanently burned the devil into the literary imagination. And folks like A.E. Waite, who was the originator of the Rider Waite Coleman Smith deck, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, was highly influenced by Milton, because everybody at that time was, because he's such an influential literary figure. So our understanding of who the devil is in tarot is very much determined by this book. And what issues the devil brings up in our readings are also determined by this book. Although I have to say that I'm using this new deck, the Witch's Wisdom Tarot, and it comes at it from a radically different perspective. And I think that the devil is called Ancestor. I've just started using this deck, but I think it's called Ancestor. And it has a really different spin, and it's deliberately going against the Christian iconography of the tarot as we know it. But most decks, even if they're revolutionary decks or they're feminist decks or they're anti-colonial decks, don't really do that. They still use this lexicon that was developed largely by Milton. So it's worth understanding at least what's going on here. Oh, and as you may or may not know, Arthur Waite is not the only person who is influenced by this book. If any of you have read or watched Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, you might know that Pullman is using Paradise Lost as a basis for the books, His Dark Materials. So remember, Lyra, main character of the books, if you're a fan, I mean, I obsessively love those things. If you haven't seen them or read them, His Dark Materials trilogy, please go out and do that because it's so great. So Lyra is Eve in these books, and she's responsible for the fall, if you'll recall. And the authority, right, those, you know, guys, they seem kind of like priests, represent God. They're not the good guys. God is not really the good guy in this book. And then the dark matter, if you remember this from the most recent season, is Satan. It's the Luciferian angels coming to try and awaken the figures, or Lyra. Anyway, all in all, the story of the fall is a story about rebellion and resistance to tyranny. A lot of people think about it. The Fall, the band, you remember them? The punk rock band? And I think they were actually referencing Camus, who probably was also referencing Milton. Anyway, this story is a story about how revolutionary movements can be corrupted by pride and vengeance and lust for power as well. But Pullman has a fascinating take on the story of the fall, which is that the fall, and just to make this clear, the fall is when Eve bites the apple and then they have to leave, you know, her and Adam have to leave the Garden of Eden. So Pullman says that the fall is an allegory for growing up. The fall is the moment when we leave childhood. That moment when we realize, for instance, that our parents aren't gods, that they can't really protect us from anything. Maybe they're the ones who are hurting us, and that we alone are responsible for our lives and choices. Now, that moment might come to you like the first time you have sex, or maybe when you move out of your parents' house, or some people reject their family of origin. The moment of the fall might be when they realize they can't have this bliss that they'd always wanted with their family. Could be that too. Whatever situation brings it on, in reality, even if it's not a traumatic one, you know, we can't remain children forever. We do grow up one day. And Pullman argues that the loss of innocence is necessary in order to achieve wisdom. As you know, crones are not innocent. They're not the fool. The crone is not the fool. The hermit is not the fool. The hermit is wise. Crones are wise. They've eaten from the tree of knowledge, and they know what it is to feel shame and to cast off that shame, to rebel against the authorities that impose that shame, and much more besides, because that's what we do when we grow up. We go through a loss of innocence, and that's necessary in order to gain wisdom. You can't really have both. In any case, this conversation is really a rich one, and I feel like I could have a semester-long graduate-level workshop on the devil card and what it means, but for now, we're going to start with this. For our subscribers, please do let us know your thoughts on this episode in the Facebook group, because I really want to unpack this one with you. It's so rich. And just a reminder, as you're listening to this episode, this is really important. Notice which parts of the story stick out for you. Like, what part about this episode, what part about the story of the fall, what part about Lucifer or Satan himself really stands out for you? What grabs your attention? And you might want to even journal about that or talk about it with a friend so that you can move that information into your long-term memory. That way, when the devil comes up in a reading, you'll be able to access the information more quickly. You'll be able to access what you learned in this episode more quickly. That's a good tip for all of our episodes. In any case, let's dive in. Okay, so Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. It is such a delight and a treat to have you here. Ever since I heard you talking about Milton in that kitchen, however many months ago, I thought to myself, I need to share this juicy information with my listeners about Satan and Paradise Lost and all of that. So here you are to talk about it.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so I imagine that most of the folks out there listening probably don't have that much of a sense of who John Milton is. So I was hoping that you could tell us.
Yeah. So John Milton, a good anchor point to think about him is he is born right at the height of Shakespeare's powers. So he's really, if you imagine an era when Shakespeare's plays are being performed in London, he's born into that world. And he's really the inheritor of Shakespeare's England. So he's like a kid growing up in Shakespeare's England. And he really is following in Shakespeare's footsteps in his ambitions to become the greatest English poet ever. He has crazy ambition. He wants to be the best of the best.
Wow. So he kind of, we'll get into this later, but so he's kind of like Satan himself, since Satan also is very ambitious, right?
Yes, yes. In a way, yeah, that's a great parallel. Yeah, you could see that he wants to do things with poems that have never been done before. And the person closest to him who's done close to what he wants to do is Shakespeare. And he also is born into a really wild time if we're just thinking about English political history, this is a moment of revolution. So he's a revolutionary and he's a radical. So this is a moment in England's history where there's going to be a faction in England that executes the King of England. So
wow.
Charles I and Milton is on the side of executing the King, which is a big deal. Scary deal. Yeah, and it's a scary deal for all of Europe at the time. They're like, what's happening? How is this possible? And Milton's on the side of, we need to have a revolution. We need to depose this king. We need to get rid of him.
Wow, I see a lot of parallels to this current moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what he wanted to depose the king, but why? Like, what did he think was wrong with the king? Was the king like Trump?
He is not quite like Trump. I would say he was less nefarious, but maybe as incompetent. So there was definitely some fiscal mismanagement going on. There was some mismanagement of religious divides within the country and religious freedom, which is a big, this is one of the things that John Milton is really in many ways attached to liberty. So he's a radical who wants people to be free and free to explore their spirituality, free to think new ideas. He's very against censorship. He writes one of the greatest tracts against censorship in his moment. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons that the king ends up getting executed.
Oh, so he does, in fact, get executed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the king, Charles I, is executed. And we have an
by just like a mob of folks.
Actually, no, by an entire rival party that takes over and establishes a republic. So there's this brief era where we get what's called the interregnum in England, which is an era without a king. for like a decade.
So there was like a decade in the midst of this, like the height of monarchy in England, where this revolution happened. The king was executed. Milton was a part of this, well, maybe like the intelligentsia of this.
Yes, this is really significant for him, actually. This is a big part of his story, is he always feels like he's behind schedule on his great poetic project.
I feel that. We all identify with that.
Yeah, he suffers even from the age of like 21. He suffers from being too, he's already late. He's got this project he's got to do. And significantly, he abandons poetry for years to write political tracts. He's like the equivalent of, you know, a kind of a propaganda machine for a radical contingent in English politics at the time. But also, he's deeply learned. So he's giving the justifications for why you can execute a king, why it's okay, which is, again, a big deal. There's the idea that monarchs were who are next to God, appointed by God in some ways. So, and you can start to see the resonances with the poem itself when you get into this, that people pick up on. But so he abandons poetry for a time to make cases for revolution, to make a case for revolution, to advance his understanding of liberty and freedom and help establish a republic within England for a brief time. And he will eventually be punished for this. There's a moment after this interregnum, this period of no monarchs, the son of the executed king returns and the monarchy is reestablished in England. And there's a really dicey moment for Milton where he may go to jail. He may be executed himself, where he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen. And it's out of that era that Paradise Lost will be finished and will be published eventually in this kind of scary era where he's reevaluating essentially a failed revolution. He's in his own country.
Wow, that's so amazing.
Yeah.
I see the parallels with the book, which we'll hear about so much in just a few minutes. And then also with the devil card, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to bring you on, so that people could really understand the nature of that card and how it is about like revolution and power and authority and all of those things. And then what you're saying is also making me think about this book that I'm reading right now called My Grandmother's Hands. And it's a book about, well, white supremacy in the United States and how it manifests in our bodies. And the author talks a lot about like how white supremacy originated in essentially England, and how the white bodies were really hurting other white bodies, and that it was a very, like, the Middle Ages in England was a very extremely violent time.
Yes, yes. Lots of corporeal punishment. This is also significant for Milton is to think about this as an era, the beginning of an era of colonization. So the discovery of, you know, quote, the new world, unquote, new to them, new to the European mind,
right,
is really a feature of the culture and early colonial exploits going on throughout North America and South America at the time are also a really, really important part of the historical background. Because when you're getting into this area, you're getting into there had been a colonial, violent colonial imagination for a long time. And this is a moment when Europe is acting it out in these new landscapes, new to them landscapes. And so that's another interesting piece of it as well.
Where do you think Milton stood in relation to all that stuff?
Well, I think about the idea of an Eden and paradise. This is something that the idea of losing paradise as definitely a part of new world, old world thinking, in that a lot of folks in this era, in the 1600s, are trying to imagine what this new to them continent is like, and they'll think of it as some kind of Eden. They don't imagine it as a place where people already have lived for 10,000 years. They imagine it as a open field to be moved into. And I think Milton is the kind of thinker who would actually worry about that. I will say this because Satan, in some ways, you could see as a kind of colonizer. He arrives from another place and lands on Earth in Eden, and he has a plan to take over and to radically change the environment that he lands in, which in some ways Milton portrays as heroic, and in other ways it's just unequivocally wrong what Satan is doing. Milton is very ambivalent, or trades in a lot of ambiguity throughout this poem. It's very hard to see where he's going to land.
Yeah, so much nuance. I'm thinking about another book that I was reading, An Indigenous History of the United States, and in it they talk about how Columbus literally wrote in his journal when he arrived in contemporary Haiti or one of the islands in the Caribbean, that he thought that he had found Eden.
Yes.
Like, he thought that he'd found Eden, and the people who were there were the people who never left Eden in his mind. But literally the first thing he thinks about is how to enslave them.
Yes.
Which I think is so mind-blowing, because I imagine that he was quite religious, or at least believed in, if he believed that it was actually Eden, then he would think that God might be mad if he did that. But this is a whole nother trajectory here.
Well, I think it's relevant, though, to think, because when we get into it, there's so much about servitude and whether you submit to people and whether Eden is a place of submission or disobedience. You can see that within the thinking of someone like Columbus, for sure.
Wow. I am so excited about this. I'm so excited just to dive in and think about all of these things. I do want to address, before we go into that, though, about this idea of epic poetry and what epic poetry was. And I remember you saying to me one time that poets at that time, because of Virgil or something, start off with pastoral poetry, which is poetry about, like, goats,
sheep,
and fields and things.
Yes.
Like, literally,
yes.
Poetry about sheep.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, paint a picture for us about how you become an epic poet in this?
Yeah, this is for all aspiring epic poets out there. You begin, and this is imitating Virgil's career, Virgil being a poet of the Roman Empire. So, you know, from many centuries before Milton is writing, and yet Milton is very interested in Virgil, and a whole bunch of other poets are interested in Virgil. Again, if you think about Rome, you think about empire. Virgil writes a poem about empire that's a big deal, the epic, the Aeneid, and it's about the founding of Rome and the empire that Rome would go on to found. And Virgil begins his career writing about sheep, and it's this fantasy that poets begin as these very natural singers. You're a shepherd singing on the hills to your sheep, and this natural poetry just flows out of you as you're sitting there on your own, spending time with your sheep. And then Virgil, after he wrote these pastoral poems, went on to write poems about farming. So you go through a whole agrarian phase. That's your kind of mid-career, and then you cap your career with an epic poem, which is often the birth of an empire or the birth of a nation. And you can see that built into this is a movement from the semi-wild environment to the civilized, again, in scare quotes, civilized world of the epic.
Of empire.
Of empire. Yeah,
right,
really of empire.
Violence and acquisition.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's so amazing that it's built into actually the structure, not only of the poem itself, but of how you become a poet, is essentially the abandonment of the natural world and the embrace of empire.
Yes. And this is actually what's so challenging for Milton is he, for a long time, wants to write a poem about Britain, a national poem, and the context of a failed revolution where he ends up with a country that isn't the country he had hoped to have made and lived in. Within that context, he in some ways has to pick a different subject matter because he can't tell the story of the rise of the British Empire anymore. He's in some ways slightly to the side or extremely to the side of what would be the British nation by the time the king's son, the executed king's son, returns. So he picks another theme, which instead of the building of an empire, is he just goes for it. And he decides to write about the entire story of all humankind from this Christian perspective of the beginning before humans even existed. He wants to tell the story of the creation of the entire universe and then the fall and then what comes after.
I mean, that is very ambitious. Yes. That is very ambitious.
Yes.
Well, so, okay, let's get into this here. So here's this politically exiled, troubled man, very learned, and he writes this epic poem, which is Paradise Lost. Let's talk about the story of Paradise Lost. So break it down for us. How does this story go?
Well, scene opens and we see it's this incredible scene. After we get a brief moment of Milton asking for inspiration to begin to tell this story, which he needs. So he calls for an inspiring voice to help him tell this story, which is a convention of epic poems. And then he goes from that to Satan on a lake of fire. So the first image we see is Satan on a lake of fire. And I was wondering, could I read a section of this so we get...
Yeah, let's hear it. I'd love to hear. Yeah.
I'm going to read a single sentence. It's a little long, but it will give you the opening scene. And even if the sentence itself is hard to follow, which it is, sometimes just the sound of Milton is the joy of this poem, is feeling the joy. So this is what we open with, Satan on a lake of fire. And here he is. Nine times the space that measures day and night to mortal men, he with his horrid crew lay vanquished, rolling in the fiery gulf, confounded though immortal. But his doom reserved him to more wrath. For now, the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Round he throws his baleful eyes that witnessed huge affliction and dismay, mixed with obdurate pride and steadfast hate.
Wow, Satan is not in a good place when this story opens.
He's in such a bad place. He's in so much pain. And the part of that that really gets me is, and this is one of the things about Satan that's so compelling, is he remembers how happy he once was. So he remembers lost happiness. There's this state he was in when he was in heaven that he is so far from now, but he can still feel it and still remember it. And to me, that's such a compelling and sensitive way to describe Satan, who is this really, for many of us, terrifying figure. But to imagine him feeling so much pain and being really, really going through it there on the lake of fire.
So how did he get to this lake of fire? And who was Satan?
So before Satan was Satan, and Satan, the name means adversary. Within Milton's poem, we don't know it is never said what his name was before. Lucifer is one of the names that Satan potentially had. In other traditions, you can see Lucifer come up, which means light bringer.
Right.
And Satan was a great angel.
Like the most beloved, right? The most beloved angel of God.
Potentially the most beloved angel, yeah.
And it's important, listeners out there, to remember that when the devil shows up in your readings, he is functioning in the tarot as the adversary. So this is going to help you really understand what is going on in the mind of this adversary and how it might be coming up in your life. I love that. Okay, so he is the most beloved angel of God. We don't really know his name. Possibly it's Lucifer, Lightbringer. And then what happens?
So things really go wrong for Satan when God presents the Son of God, who is not quite Jesus yet, but is is a being who will volunteer to become Jesus and redeem all human beings later. But before that moment, God presents the Son of God, who is suddenly the most, single most favored being in all of heaven.
Okay, wait, let me just make sure I'm understanding this.
Yes.
So Satan was once Lucifer. He was the most beloved, like, angel in heaven, and there were all these angels in heaven, and things were great, and they all just basked in the glory of God all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And then in comes this being who is the Son of God, not Jesus yet, but he's about to volunteer to become Jesus, to come down to earth and redeem all of humankind. So Satan is dealing with this new guy coming in.
Yeah, this new guy arrives, and Satan is profoundly wounded by losing, this is my understanding of it, the way that I read the poem, Satan loses his place and misses it. It's trying to imagine having the most powerful love ever experienced, God's love, and getting to just feel it in its full effect. And all of a sudden, there's someone who's better than you, who's even more loved than you. And Satan does not process this well and ends up calling for a rebellion within heaven. And
but was God bad to him? Like, was Satan just jealous? Like, this new guy comes in and he just feels hurt by that? Or did God do something to make him feel that way?
All God does is present the Son of God and say, you will obey the Son of God as you obey me. Here is this incredible force that I'm bringing into the universe and into heaven, the Son of God. And Satan can't handle it.
But why doesn't God say, I still love you just as much. Here's this new figure. This is your new stepmom or whatever. And she loves you too, or he loves you too. Why doesn't God help Satan understand?
Yeah, this is a great question. And there was a really brilliant critic in the 1940s who said that this God is evil in Milton's telling, that this God is actually, this God is not good. And of course, that sets off in the scholarship of Milton, which many people, like, you could spend much of your life diving into. People are like, no, the God is good. No, the God is bad. You could go back and forth. But there is an argument to make that why is God making it so hard on not just Satan, but the angels that Satan recruits then to create war in heaven to overthrow the Son of God and get their place back?
Well, yeah, because also if Lucifer was the most beloved angel, then we already see that there was already a hierarchy of love, and some people were loved more and some people were loved less, or some angels were loved more and less.
Yeah.
So Satan is mad about this new figure, and then Satan decides we need to rebel against this guy.
Yes. And this is the seduction of rebellion too, which again resonates with our current history too. You know, feeling like you're a rebel is a very seductive feeling, and it can kind of cut both ways depending on what you believe in. And so Satan manages to recruit all these angels. There's a war in heaven. Satan loses, and for his disobedience, for his war, he is, Milton describes it as hurled headlong into hell, which God creates for Satan because of this moment. So hell opens up.
Wait.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, wait. So Satan, mm-hmm. God's most beloved angel, gets mad at God because he feels abandoned by him. He starts a revolution, and then God says, you are so bad that I'm going to create a special place to torment you, which is hell. I'm going to create it just for you and all your
rebel angels,
revolutionaries.
Yes.
And I'm going to cast you into it. And then isn't there a part where, like, doesn't one of the other angels, like Michael or something, take part in this casting out? Or, like,
Yes. There's a war among the angels. So the angel Michael participates, wounds Satan. And it's a very intense scene. And the Son of God is the kind of nuclear option who comes out and is the one who rolls all the angels out.
Whoa.
So the angels are warring with each other. And then the Son of God says, after 3 days of war in heaven, the Son of God shows up and says, I'll get this. And the Son of God.
Hold my beer.
Yeah, exactly. The Son of God's like, hold my beer, takes care of it, sends Satan and all the rebel angels into hell, which is, again, that this really, to me, when I look at this poem, I see a love story gone wrong. You know, I see toxic relationships all over the place. And this is one, you know, the Son of God, whom Satan had been so injured by, the Son of God getting to sit at the right hand of God and Lucifer feeling diminished somehow. The Son of God is the one who then gets to cast him out with all his angels. And then he ends up in that scene burning on the lake of fire.
Where we open the story. Mm-hmm. So he's like, so he's remembering all this, that he loved God so much and all he wanted to do was be in his presence. And then here comes this other guy who God loves more. He feels so hurt that he gets cast out. He ends up in a lake of fire, a hell built just for him,
yeah.
Which must really hurt if you think that the person you love best in the world has created this place of torment just for you that you're supposed to live in now for the rest of eternity.
Yeah. And this is another part of the tragedy. And what's really interesting is Milton actually thought about writing this poem as a Shakespearean style tragedy. And one of the speculations is that maybe he couldn't do it because he couldn't stage Adam and Eve naked on stage. That's one reason that would have been difficult in the moment to do.
Yeah.
But part of the tragedy of this story is that Satan does have moments of realization where he thinks, maybe I just should have been grateful for the love that I did get. And God, when God is explaining what happened later, he says, I gave him all he needed. I gave him all he had. He did have my love. He just didn't understand it.
Why didn't he explain that to
exactly,
him? Why didn't he say, listen, I still love you. Like, this is not about this something being better than you. Please let me help you understand this. Why does he not have that kind of compassion for him?
Tragic miscommunication. And I do think this is exactly the kind of question that Milton wants us to take up. And I should say that Milton says his purpose in this poem is to justify the ways of God to man. That's his purpose. He's gonna.
Is that effective? Because
exactly.
I'm like, dude, this is
I
not
know,
because
we're left with way more questions than answers here. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so then what happens? So he's there in this lake of fire. Then what happens?
So he does something that some may say is very heroic. In that he gets up from this burning lake of fire, and he has a shield on his back and a spear that looks as big as the moon and a spear that's as big as a pine. And he rallies everyone, and he says, basically, one, don't be too bummed out, because the mind is its own place. We're not in hell because we have our minds.
We're free.
Exactly. We can be free. And that's better than being in servitude in heaven. We're no longer locked in servitude. We're free here in our own minds. And he says, I've heard there's this new place where God has made these new beloved creatures, human beings, Adam and Eve. And what if we go and see I can go find those new people and I can mess with them. And that will be our revenge. So these are the two things that he proposes early in the poem.
Wow.
Yeah.
But this is so wild. Okay, so here he is, like, utterly defeated, in chains in this lake of fire. And he tells all of his fellow revolutionaries, we are not actually imprisoned. Because we still have freedom in our mind. And when we were in heaven, we didn't have that freedom. We were beholden to this tyrannical God.
Yes.
And I am going to go find this thing that he now loves best in the world. And I'm going to fuck with it.
Yes.
And we are going to get him back for all he did to us.
And he says, the only mistake we made was underestimating how essentially, you could say physically or metaphysically strong God was. But Satan says, that was my only mistake. We couldn't win that battle, but we can be devious and we can use our intelligence to corrupt the world.
Wow. So this is so much like a rebellion against empire in a way, because like, for instance, if you were rebelling against the Roman Empire and you were smaller, like you were Gaul or you were, you know, the Germans or the, you know, the English, like you couldn't resist with weapons because they're stronger than you. They have a bigger navy. They have a bigger military. They're more powerful. So he's saying, I underestimated how powerful militarily this God was, but I now know that the way to undermine him is through subterfuge or through more devious tactics, kind of behind the scenes, attacking what he holds dear.
Absolutely.
So then he takes this massive voyage, right?
So he gets out of hell, and it's kind of a jailbreak. If you think about epic stories like the Odyssey, where you have a heroic, complicated man who goes on a crazy sea voyage. This is Milton's heroic moment for Satan of going on a journey. So he journeys out of hell through chaos. You get some very wild descriptions of the entire universe as it was understood in the 17th century. And the universe understood as a set of crystalline concentric spheres spinning around each other.
So Satan is like flying through these like Superman, heading to Earth.
He's heading to Earth and he gets close to the sun and he starts, this is another really sad moment. He gets close to the sun and he's feeling the brightness of heaven again as he gets close to the sun. He loses his path and he encounters an angel. And this is again one of these moments where Satan is reminded of what he once was. This angel is this brilliant light appearing to him. And he, one of Satan's abilities throughout Paradise Lost is he can shapeshift. So he transforms and he transforms himself into a little cherub and he shows up in front of this angel as a little cherub. And he says, I really want to go celebrate this new creation I've heard about, but I don't know the way. Can you point the way? And this angel doesn't recognize this cherub as Satan and says, oh yeah, you just go that way, essentially. In Miltonic, much drawn out in the poem, but Milton sends Satan via the angel to Earth to go meet Adam and Eve and discover Eden, and that's where Satan ends up. And then this is where we're gonna witness eventually the fall of Adam and Eve. Eve going first, and Satan famously appearing as a snake to Eve.
So he shows up at this garden. And he's looking in there and he's thinking, this is so beautiful. And here are these creatures that God loves so much. And they're in this pastoral environment. And he's just remembered that he's been reminded that he's fallen from this grace as he passes this angel who's so beautiful and bright and beloved. And so he gets there having just remembered how far he's fallen. And then what does he do when he sees Adam and Eve?
When he sees them, we get, in some ways you could read it as a real villain speech of, here's what I'm going to do to you. But there's a line from it that always really affects me and makes me feel emotional every time I read it, because he says, league with you, I seek. Like, I want to be in league with you, Adam and Eve. Like, I want to be close to you. He wants them to be with him because he's so wounded and alone. And because he's fallen so far, again, you can see him striving for that feeling of love that he once had. And he can see it now reflected in Adam and Eve. And he says, in the villainous part of the speech, he says, I'm going to make room for you in hell with me. We're going to go there back there together. And he's like the worst. He's going to be like the worst roommate ever. But there's a really sad, sad feeling to it where he wants connection with them. He recognizes their beauty. He recognizes their perfection and wants to have closeness with them. That's what he desires most of all. And yet he's set on this course of revenge.
But also, like, he does truly believe that God is a tyrant, right?
Yes. Yeah, yes. That's very true to him, that God is a tyrant.
And that one day Adam and Eve are going to know somehow. Like, he decides, too, that he's going to tell them what a tyrant God is. And they are just in this blissful ignorance, being like, he made us this great garden. We're just living in it. It's wonderful. Just like Satan had been.
Yes.
And then Satan is really hurt, and he wants to be close to these figures, and he knows that God is not what they think he is.
Yes, and this is almost precisely what he's going to tell Eve when he appears to Eve as a snake, which happens. We get really interesting scenes. You get an image of Adam and Eve's life in Eden, and they're doing great. They are surrounded by animals that don't hurt each other. All the animals are in perfect harmony. There's fruit rolling off the trees. They have tons of food. They do work. They do some gardening. They have a lot of sex. That's a really interesting part. They have shameless sex with each other, because this is before shame. And they have conversations with angels. So they get to have, angels will come down and literally have a meal with them and talk. And they get to learn about the world of angels and the beginning of creation and how they came to be and how the world came to be. So they have this very rich physical and intellectual life in Eden. And yet, as you say, Satan wants to let them know that maybe this world they're in isn't all it seems. And we get a glimpse of this, actually. Eve is such an incredible figure in this poem. And one of Eve's early scenes, in one of her early scenes, she tells Adam about what she remembers as her first memory. And her first memory is waking up on a bank and then looking at herself, looking at her reflection in water. And she's so enamored with her own image. She's feeling this, she recognizes her own beauty, and yet she doesn't really realize it's her. It's a bit of a narcissism moment. And she's looking at herself and is feeling this reflected love back and is just really loving herself. And Adam is the one who actually shows up and ruins it, because he's like, no, you have to come with me. And he grabs her hand and pulls her away from her own image. And this, in some ways, is a foreshadowing or a setup of what Eve's looking for when Eve goes to the tree of knowledge, which is the one thing. And this is the prohibition. This is where if you wanted to make a case for God's tyranny, this is where it comes in. God says to Adam and Eve, basically, you are in Eden. You can do what you want to do, but don't do this one thing, which is eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge. That's the one thing you can't do. And doesn't explain why. Just says,
so unfair.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Because I don't want you to. Because I said so.
Exactly. And Eve eventually will end up breaking away from Adam on her own when they have been warned that Satan is on the scene. He's in the garden somewhere. They know. And Adam is very concerned and wants Eve to obey him as well, and wants her to stay close by him, because he's worried that if she's out there on her own, Satan's definitely going to find her. And Eve makes the case that she wants to go on her own, and she goes on her own and ends up discovering the snake who leads her to the tree of knowledge. And the snake, Satan as serpent, tells Eve, look at how beautiful you are. And this is, again, a reflection of that early moment when she sees herself. Don't you see how beautiful and how incredible you are? You should be like a goddess among gods. Why are you here alone with only one man to see you? You have this one guy and that's it? Is that really all there is here? So that's one of his cases. He also makes the case, look what I ate from the tree of knowledge, and now I'm a talking snake. So
that's pretty magical.
Yeah, imagine what it's going to do for you. You already talk. And then that's what leads to Eve eating the fruit, which is knowledge.
But does he mention that, like, what kind of a god would put this tree here and say not to eat it? Like, why do you think he's asked you not to eat it? Like, it, does he plant that doubt in her mind or not really? Or
in a way he does. One of the things he says to her is, she says, but if we disobey, we know we will die. This is the thing they know, that that if they disobey this one commandment, they will end up dying. And she says that to Satan, and he's like, oh no, God would never do that to you. Are you sure? What kind of, he basically says, he says the question that many readers end up having, what kind of God would do that? So this question we're having is exactly the question that Satan poses to her. What kind of God would kill you for eating this fruit? That seems a little extreme. That's one of the cases that he makes to her as he convinces her to take the fruit.
And I mean, good question, right? Because they're set up as being kind of naive creatures, right? They're created by God. He made them in his, you know, in his image, I guess, but kind of naive version. And then sets them up kind of for failure.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was thinking while you were saying all of this that to me, there is a lot of allegory with like white supremacist empire, because the idea is like in, for instance, a, you know, colonialist worldview, you have all this abundance, right? All the abundance of England, all the abundance of France, all the abundance of Spain, lavish palaces and, you know, wealth and power. And the thing you're not supposed to ask is, well, how did we get this? How did we get here?
Yes.
And so there's like a, you're not supposed to look under the hood and acknowledge what was the cause of this wealth and abundance. At least that's what's coming up for me.
Yeah, or that Adam and Eve are supposed to, like Satan was supposed to, just accept it as some act of generosity or abundance that they deserve. And the act of questioning it, even the fact that it's called the tree of knowledge, and that's the thing that's forbidden, is a, for modern readers, and I think readers in Milton's time, you're like, oh yeah, why do we not want to know things? Don't we want to know things? Don't we want to know? And even don't we want to know about the reality of death? Don't we want to know that's part of what it means to be human, is to die? And don't we want to know that? Why are we so afraid of it? And that is part of what Satan is asking. Why are we so afraid of this?
So then Satan presents these arguments to Eve and she goes, yeah, you've got a point here. And then she eats the apple.
Yes, she eats the apple. Big mistake. She realizes.
So as soon as she bites into it, she's like, oh shit, what did I just do?
Yes, yes. And then pretty soon Adam is on the scene and he's saying, what'd you just do? And then they have a beautiful moment as a couple where Adam says, I can't let you do this alone, essentially. And he also partakes of the tree of knowledge so that they will fall together. And the rest of the poem is reckoning with this moment of what they have done and how it's going to, how the Son of God shows up to judge them and to judge the serpent. Satan is sent back to hell and he shows up back to hell. And there's this great moment where he shows up and he's like, I did it. I'm done.
And he's like, I did what I was set out to do.
Yeah.
They're screwed now.
Exactly. And then what he gets in response is just a hiss. And all these former angels are now turned into serpents and they're all hissing at him. So it's not as celebratory as he would have hoped when he returns. And then the very final words of the poem are Adam and Eve being led out of Eden on their own. And there is some definite ambivalence in these last lines that maybe, if you don't mind, I'll just read a few of the last lines.
Sure, let's hear them.
Because they're it's a beautiful end to the poem. Here they are. This is when they're led out of the eastern gate of Eden and they're now led out of what had been their home. Some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way.
Wow. So now they're on their own, out in this wild world.
Yeah, exactly.
Will you hold on to my hand? I'm falling forwards, farther than before. Falling farther, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, falling, and I'm falling, and still falling.
Okay, so this leaves us with a lot of questions, and this is a very rich and deep book, so we can't cover every little nuance of it, but I do really want to go into some of the qualities of Satan / Lucifer so that people can understand a little bit more what's happening when it comes up in their readings. So one of the things I wanted to address was, so there's, he has many different qualities, which are what make him, you know, the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those qualities, for instance, is pride. That's something that we hear, you know, pride goeth before the fall. And I guess it means literally like the fall of man. Pride is what happened. That's what led to the fall of man or human beings. So what is the problem with pride? Is it that we don't submit to God's will? Is it that Satan doesn't submit to God's will? Is it that we have our own preferences or believe that we're right? I mean, to me, pride in the case of this story seems like it's anti-authoritarian. So I'm for that. But so what's Milton's belief in this pride being a bad thing?
I would say, in my understanding of Milton's representation of pride, pride is a corrupted form of love. It's a corrupted self-love in a way. So again, if we go back to Eve looking at herself and love it, feeling love from herself, and then Satan in some ways playing into that. What Satan does is, and this is a characteristic he has, he plays into the idea that we would love ourselves and then corrupt that love so that it makes you forget the source of all love, which is God. This is, again, within Milton's Christian presentation. So pride is a kind of self-love gone wrong, gone astray, gone wild. That seems to be part of the problem with it. And yet Milton leaves enough room to be like, well, why was it so bad to feel that pride, to feel that sense of that sense of yourself that Satan feels?
Because it seems to me that that's a way of like empire or power or tyranny convincing you not to listen to your own feelings, to convincing you to shut down your own experience in favor of whatever the tyrant is telling you you ought to feel.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important way to see what's happening when we think about Satan as attractive. When we have sympathy for him, he's standing up for himself. He's trying to let his feelings come through. You know, he feels things. Satan is this character who deeply, deeply feels things. He feels woundings and he remembers how good it was in heaven. He also knows that he feels the pain of hell. He also can move between these realms. Yeah, he's a very interesting character in that way. And pride being a part of it is like, oh, you kind of don't want him to be any less prideful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real question. I mean, I think that is something that comes up in the tarot, like this idea of pride or selfishness or like a lack of compassion. But it is interesting the way it manifests here. Because when I think of the devil as the antagonist, in this story, it's kind of difficult to tell whether it's Satan who's the antagonist or if it's God who's the antagonist, because God's the one who's doing, like, kind of starting it. And he's the one who's doing all the punishing. But then But then, and Satan is like resisting and is really feeling his feelings and feeling very tormented. And then, yeah, acting out in a way that is definitely not probably what we would hope or recommend. Like, but then if he didn't, then he's supposed to be like better or more mature, emotionally mature than God is. I mean, that feels a little unfair. I mean, what we're getting at here too, I think, and one of the things that makes him troubling is this idea of vengeance.
Yes.
Because Satan lures Eve to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge because he wants vengeance on God for betraying him. But God really did betray him in a really cruel way. I mean, he was like, listen, you love me so much that you can't accept Jesus, so I'm going to punish you for all of eternity by torturing you.
And not only that, but there's a way to see it that, okay, so then God also is setting it up so that in the history of human beings, all these humans are going to end up in hell with Satan too. So like that's part of this it's not just punishment for Satan, it's like punishment for all of us.
Right, because God knew that that's what would happen.
So it's pretty extreme.
Dang.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about this idea of vengeance though. So for instance, if the devil card comes up in a tarot reading, this idea of wanting to get back at someone who has harmed you or resisting tyranny in a way that could lead to more violence or more brutality seems to be something that that is being brought up by this idea of the devil and how he's playing out in this book.
Yes, and I would say that Paradise Lost definitely, as much as you will find yourself aligned with Satan or rooting for Satan, in the end, Satan's plan for vengeance doesn't seem like a winning strategy. So the vengeance itself, his strategy of vengeance seems to leave him. In some ways, he very literally ends up where he started, back in hell. And although human beings are going to join him there, it's a bit of a hollow victory for him that the strategy of vengeance, being driven by vengeance rather than love, has not served him well by the end of the poem.
Right, because it doesn't really get him what he wants. Like he ultimately what he wants is love and acceptance and communion. And he's so angry that he doesn't know how to get that. And so the way that he goes about getting it is by causing more harm.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's definitely something to look at if the devil card comes up in a reading, is the way that you might be doing that. Is what you're doing really going to get you the thing that you want? Or is it just going to provide like the short-term satisfaction? There's a couple more things that I want to think about before we wrap up here. So a couple of the qualities that I see as being present in Satan Lucifer here are corruption, or the ability to corrupt something, deception, and I think perhaps most importantly, shame. Because I think that this idea of shame is something that's really built into this idea of the devil, this whole storyline. It seems like Satan felt shame when the Son of God came, right? He felt like, oh, I'm not as good. I'm not enough. I'm not worthy of love. I'm not as worthy of God's love as this other figure is. And then he projects that shame. Again, going back to that book, My Grandmother's Hands, who's the author's name is slipping me now, but it'll be in the show notes for anybody who's interested. This idea that when we feel shame or experience violence, often what we'll do if we can't contain that or we can't metabolize that within our own body is like project it through the body of somebody else. So we try and like transmit what we're feeling into some other being or figure. And it definitely seems like that's what's happening here when Satan decides, you know, I'm so miserable and I feel so hurt that I'm going to go find someone who can hold this pain for me.
Yes. The clearest sign of this is that when Adam and Eve leave Eden, they have to be clothed. So they have to have animal skins put on them. And this is because they're ashamed. And Satan, in some ways, has passed his feeling of shame onto them. And they carry it out in that moment where they, the world is before them. One of the things they're going to have to carry with them that Satan has passed on is the shame as well. He's passed it on. And it's something totally new to them within this poem. And it's really for Milton to imagine that the very first moment that humans experienced shame, that's so much what this poem is about and how deep that is in our formation as human beings. And he tells that story through Satan as well, this fallen angel. And then that's how we got it. And that's how, I believe that shame drives so much of our human interactions and who we are as humans when we let it run wild. And Milton's trying to tell that story too.
Do you think that it relates to Milton's place in history, like with this whole revolutionary impulse against, you know, killing the king, for instance? As we were, you know, kind of looping back to the beginning, this idea of this story as being a story of resistance to tyranny that goes wrong. And I mean, do you feel like shame plays into that?
Yes. I'm trying to think through how shame fits in the resistance to tyranny. And I think I would say that Satan and Adam and Eve, or maybe just Satan and Eve, really want to push limits that are imposed on them. And when they do that, they are forced to experience shame, the shame of getting past the limits. And at the same time, by going through the experience of shame, they also are propelled into new worlds. Each of them do get to discover new things that they didn't have before by working through shame. And I think with Satan, he seems to end up getting locked and lost in shame. With Eve and Adam and Eve, I would say that they are potentially, in those last lines of the poem, offered to us as a way out. That there may be a way to work with shame and to work through it, and that's part of learning how to navigate hierarchies that you may find yourself in. That the hierarchy is going to make you feel shame, because the hierarchy is going to try to keep you where you are, and when you move out of it, the hierarchy is going to try to make you feel some bad feelings.
Yeah. I hear this, like, for instance, like within our culture, you know, the tyranny, as we've been discussing, of white supremacy or capitalism or colonialism, or just like body shame, which we all are so familiar with, you know, that the status quo or the powers that be will try and make you feel like you need deodorant, or you need to buy diet products, or you need to wax your legs, or you need to do all of these things in order to prevent yourself from feeling shame or feeling not good enough. But that the power that be is the one that constructed this paradigm to begin with. And it seems that there's an argument in here, whether or not Milton knew that he was making it, that yes, if you resist tyranny, you will have to confront the things that it's trying to used to keep you trapped, and you will have to move through shame, you will have to move through hurt or punishment in some way, because most tyrannical systems aren't just going to let you waltz right out, you know, or eat whatever you want, you know, they are always trying to control you. But it seems like there is something here about owning your power, or like knowing the truth and living that truth, and then being able to find redemption through love in some way. It seems like that's later what goes on in the story.
Absolutely. And you know, the question will be, should all of these fallen characters have just trusted God? Should they have just trusted that that love was real and that that love was the single most important thing on earth and in heaven, and they should have just gone with it? Or were they right to question it and to wonder what other experiences they might have if they started to seek out other kinds of feelings and other, maybe a different kind of love that is separate? You know, there's some readings of Milton out there that say maybe he was even an atheist in his thinking, that that's even possible, that he was that wild a thinker, because he really was that wild a radical in many ways. It's possible to imagine that he definitely seems that he was for more possibilities rather than less in the realm of existence.
I love that so much. And I feel like that's a really good place to kind of wrap this conversation up, which is, you know, thank you so much for this whole very deep and profound exploration of this subject. I feel like the question that you asked just now, you know, is it better to just go with what you're told to do if it prevents you from experiencing pain? Or is resistance necessary? Is it the right choice? And how do you resist? What is the right way to resist? And these are all things that I feel like the devil as the antagonist, or Lucifer, Lightbringer, bringer of awareness, is asking, and asking when it comes up in a reading, that nobody can give you that answer, that we each have to make that decision for ourselves.
And that, which we didn't even touch on, but that's free will, which
yeah,
is what this poem is so much about.
Okay, well.
We didn't even touch it, but we got to it, because that's so perfect what you just said. That's free will, and that's what Milton's about.
Yeah, and that I think is what the devil card is about too. So I feel like there we go, we cracked it. Well, Michael, thank you so much. This has been just so enlightening and so rich. I am so grateful to you for being here. Could you tell us more about where we can find out about your work and, you know, what's next for you?
Of course. Yeah. And thank you so much. This is such a joy and a pleasure. And if folks want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at ursel.michael.
And we'll put that in the show notes.
On the Twitter. And right now, you know, I spend a lot of my time advocating for artists in Las Vegas and what I now call the Greater Mojave.
Yeah.
I advocate for artists and writers here, and that's a big part of what I do. But also you can watch for the occasional writing project that I will often post about on Twitter when my writing projects come out, like a piece I'm writing right now about the song Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones.
Yes, I was just listening to that song, the version by Graham Parsons, last night, and just melting into the floor with such delight. And I really wait to read that essay. So I'm going to let you go get back to it now so that I can read it soon. Thanks again.
Cool.
And we're so glad you were with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in today, listeners. Check back in with us next week when we'll be learning how to break free of ruts with the Eight of Swords and Crow Mother, Eliza Fenster. You might recognize that name from Instagram. Don't forget to join us for Tarot Studio tonight at 6 p.m. and to sign up for my moon ceremony tomorrow, also at 6 p.m. The link for both of those is in the show notes. Bye for now. Sorry, one last thing. In this episode, I mentioned a couple times a really important book, My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. And in the episode, in the heat of the moment, the author's name slipped my mind, but I wanted to let you know that it is by Resma Menakem. And I highly recommend it. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes as well. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Subscribers to our Weird Circle at the Jupiter level get workshops, community, bonus content, and magical support throughout the year. we really do hope that you join us. In the meantime, if you love our content and want to keep us on the air, please do take a moment to give us 5 stars or leave us a sweet review on iTunes, or share your favorite moments from the podcast on social media. Truly, all of it makes a huge difference to us. You can tag me at Oracle Valet or at Between the Worlds Podcast. Not only does your support help keep us on the air, it helps baby witches who really need this content know how to find their way to us between the worlds. So thank you for being here, and thank you for helping other people find their way here as well. This podcast is hosted by Amanda Yates Garcia and produced by Carolyn Pennypacker Ricks. Our icon was created by Maria Minnis, aka Tiny Parsnip, and our graphic design is by Leah Hayes. Thanks for flying with us.